Welcome to Little Atoms on Resonance 104.4 FM, a live talk show about ideas and culture, with an emphasis on ideas of the Enlightenment.
Little Atoms is presented by Neil Denny, Padraig Reedy, Richard Sanderson and Becky Hogg, as well as regular guest presenters.
Little Atoms actively promotes science, freedom of expression, scepticism and secular humanism.
Our guests bring ideas that are challenging, sometimes controversial, often polemical, but always interesting.
Good evening, welcome to another edition of Little Atoms, tonight with me, Neil Denny, and I'm welcoming back to the show for the third time, Dr. Stuart Clark. Dr. Stuart Clark is one of the UK's most widely read astronomy journalists, a former editor of Astronomy Now. He has a PhD in astrophysics and until 2001 was director of public astronomy education at the University of Hertfordshire. In 2001, The Independent ranked him alongside Stephen Hawking and Sir Martin Rees, the Astronomer Royal, as one of the stars of British astrophysics teaching. A regular contributor to such magazines as New Scientist and BBC Focus, he is the author of several non-fiction books, including Galaxy, The Sun Kings and The Big Questions Universe. Stuart then embarked upon an epic series of fiction, The Sky's Dark Labyrinth Trilogy, now in its second book, The Sensorium of God, and we'll be talking about both of these books tonight. So, Stuart, welcome back to Little Atoms, first of all.
Thank you very much for inviting me, Neil. It's great to be here.
The first time you were on the show, we talked about Sun Kings, your book, which is a non-fiction book. It's a rendering of a historical period, has various distinct characters and a strong narrative, but it's a non-fiction book. Why did you then decide to do these ones as fiction? It seems like a very, very tiny difference.
Yes, I thought it was going to be a tiny difference as well, and boy, was I wrong. The Sun Kings was this sort of narrative non-fiction structure, and I tried to use and employ some techniques from novel writing to make it as interesting to read as possible, such as where I had recorded dialogue, I could include that. And I was very strict about the structure. The Sun Kings is actually structured like a three-act play. And in Canada, in fact, it was sent out by a Vancouver newspaper to a fiction writer and reviewed on their fiction pages, and which was quite bemusing, I think, to me and the reviewer. He didn't necessarily give it a bad review, I have to say. And this is what started us thinking, well, these are just such terrific stories, the history of astronomy, the characters in there, Galileo and Newton and Einstein. And the more I looked into these stories, I thought, actually, they lived such dramatic lives that the best route to telling these stories for right now, for the widest possible audience, would be to dramatise them.
Beyond the obvious fact that with a non-fiction book we expect some sort of veracity, and with a fiction book you can basically make it up as you go along. You're obviously working in the medium of historical fiction, so we are still expecting there to be, you are going to be telling a story that actually we know already happened and we know what happens. So what's the difference in the challenge there then in sort of telling that, if you're going to be sort of fictionalising parts of it?
Yeah, so the idea is, I think, how to maintain an integrity about what you're doing, how to stick to the facts, how to stick to the chronology. And one of the things that I have thought has not worked about trying to fictionalise, if you like, real events, mm-hmm. is if people try and just document everything as if it were a non-fiction exhaustive biography. And so one of the things that I did was pick and choose the moments that I dramatized so that when you put all of those together, it made a satisfying story. So that was the principal aim for choosing the parts of the story that I did. They would work together as a cohesive whole. And I also felt that, every scientist knows that when you do an experiment, you have your data points, and those are the things that you absolutely know. For example, Galileo's trial, Galileo's first use of the telescope, Kepler's arrival in Prague to meet Tycho Brahe. Those were like my data points. And then every scientist interpolates between the two. Mm-hmm. And so that's where the invention comes in, imagining what Kepler would have felt when he was in Prague, imagining the dialogues and the conversations between him and Tycho, and just trying to just put some more of that humanity and that human interest into the stories.
I suppose as well, I mean, it must give you more of a leeway in terms of viewpoint as well. In the first two books, certainly, and I presume the third will have that in common, are quite a lot concerned with the domestic arrangements of the people and look at it from that point of view, which would be a very specific non-fiction, the story of Johannes Kepler, a history of Johannes Kepler as seen through his, would would be a very particular type of non-fiction book, wouldn't it?
Yes, Kepler's Marriage.
Yes. Yeah.
So and that fascinated me as well, really, because no one works in a vacuum, and sometimes I think if you are just treating science as a thing and people's work as a thing in a non-fiction realm, you lose some of the warmth, you lose some of the context, and in this way, I could bring that back in. I could show what Kepler was like. We've got his letters where he talks about his fractious marriage with his wife and ultimately the tragedy of that marriage. And I felt that was all important to character building him as a person, as a devout religious person who is capable of extreme clarity of thought and sense of purpose. And as he deals with everything that's going on around him, both with his marriage and with the wider issue of the prelude to the 30 Years' War between the Protestant and the Catholic churches, he also keeps this vision of what he wants to do with maths and how he wants to understand the motion of the planets. And I just felt that by putting all of that together in this narrative, storytelling, fictionalised structure, you perhaps empathised more and maybe even got a little more of an insight into what it is to be a scientist and to be driven in that way.
How much freedom do you allow yourself then in terms of the fictionalised section? So of course, apart from as you've just mentioned, there are, you know, you might be able to see letters and domestic things like that, but of course most conversations that you create between people are going to be made up. But to what extent are you like supporting characters, for instance, you know, or do you give yourself any sort of leeway, or are all the minor characters real historical figures as well? Or
most of the minor characters are also historical figures that I can take them from. In the first book, The Sky's Dark Labyrinth, there is one fictitious character, and he's called Cardinal Pipe. And one of the things I became utterly fascinated with about the Galileo story is that this idea that Galileo was persecuted by the Catholic Church purely for science, purely for the audacity, really, of studying astronomy. Mm-hmm. I didn't find that really stacked up at all. It's much more nuanced, and it's much more about power plays and power structure. It's a labyrinthine story of intrigue and infighting and backstabbing and all of that. But I needed, really, I thought, to have a character who could express the commonly held view and that this was what the Catholic Church was all about, demonising astronomy. And there was also there's a moment that we know happened where the Pope changes his mind about Galileo and about his intentions, whether Galileo's intentions are good, or they're good one minute, they're bad sort of the next. And we don't really truly know why and how that change came about. And so I could put the speculation for that into this cardinal, into Cardinal Pipe. And then at least when people are reading this, I can say, look, everything in Pipe is made up, essentially. That stuff, treat with a grain of salt. He's the device that can drag the story along and help us get to the truth of the matter. Now, in the Sensorium of God, the fictional character there is the spy master, Winslow, and he does exactly the same. He helps me fill in all the bits we really, really don't know. And because I can say to people, look, Winslow is made up, that's the grain of salt stuff. Interestingly, in the third book that I'm writing at the moment, the Einstein story, that's so well documented, I don't need a fictitious character.
Did you find there's differences in, let's for instance say, you have to explain in to some degree Kepler's laws of planetary motion in the first book. Are there sort of different techniques for explaining complex scientific theories through the medium of fiction rather than having to, you know, absolutely explicitly lay it out in a non-fiction book?
Yes, I think there are, and I've taken quite a lot of that way of doing it from journalism, my journalism, which is all really about not explaining anything you don't absolutely have to. So in clear and concise scientific journalism, it's all about really what you leave out rather than what you put in. The desire is to be accurate in what you say rather than precise in the level and depth of detail that you go into. And so you can have a bit of a dumb character, if you like, who needs it explaining to. That's not that satisfactory. Or you can just find ways of dropping things in conversation so that over the course of a passage, a scene, the reader picks up enough so that they know what's going on. The one thing I did find fantastically difficult in the first book was Kepler's third law. Mm-hmm. And so I have the scene where he's explaining it to his mother. And his mother says to him, I just have no idea what you're saying. And that was taken. That was taken from my childhood. As a young boy, I would rush home to explain physics or something, you know, to my mother, and I was just like aghast with this new thing. And so I used to regularly send her to sleep explaining what I'd learned in physics that day to her. And that's a direct quote from her. Yes, I've got no idea what you're saying, but don't stop talking.
Well, let's hope that is the least of the comparisons. Then, as Kepler's mother was didn't have a great time, did she?
Yes, I can categorically say my mother was never tried for being a witch. I never had to defend her in a witch trial.
Let's have a more specific look at the Sky's Dark Labyrinth, which is the first book of the trilogy. So the main characters are Galileo, Kepler, and Tycho Brahe, as someone who's very familiar to our listeners, I'm sure. So we probably won't concentrate on Tycho too much. But you mentioned before that, and I think this is often forgotten, that both Galileo and Kepler they're living at a time where, you know, religion is the absolute norm, and they're often thought of as being sort of not necessarily even proto-atheists, but certainly very early scientists. But they're absolutely working within the system. They're basically wanting to prove God's laws rather than disprove God.
Yes, that's absolutely right. They are extremely religious. And Kepler writes a letter to one of his patrons where he says his aim is to prove that the universe is not a kind of a living being, but it's a kind of clockwork. Mm-hmm. And that the clockwork, if you say a clockwork is beautiful, then you are glorifying the creator of the clockwork. And he believes that the universe runs in the same way that a clock runs. A clock runs because of the pull of a weight. He believes the universe runs because it was set into motion by God. And so he is looking for the design, if you like, of the universe. Galileo, the same, is absolutely devout about the Catholic Church. And this is the rivalry between them. Kepler is a Lutheran Protestant and Galileo is a Catholic. And both are seeking to find this new knowledge, this new understanding for their own church and for the glorification of God.
And the thing that causes Kepler so much trouble and so much doubt now seems such a distance, such a minor thing. But of course, from the ancient Greeks, we'd had this idea that orbits were like perfect. There was something about a perfect circle, which was divine, which was like clearly, you know, the universe was made in perfect form by God because of perfect circles. And of course, Kepler's discovery of the fact that we actually have elliptical orbits is, you know, was very troubling to him.
It's absolutely key to his success, really. And I think it's a fantastic object lesson in science as well, in that you have to constantly question your assumptions. What will always hold us back in science is not so much the gathering of the data, but the seeking to interpret that data in what we think we know, the invisible assumptions that we have. So always, always, always question your assumptions, which is what Kepler finally did, extremely reluctantly, but made one of the greatest breakthroughs in the human mind has ever made. He suddenly made the celestial realm understandable to human beings. So it is a watershed moment in all human history.
It's interesting that it is often looked at as being like taking sort of very first small steps towards a more scientific method. And, you know, that was going to link us onto the next book, which we'll get onto after the break. But just one last thing at that same sort of period of time. Kepler and Galileo were, as well as being astronomers, they were astrologers. There was no, you know, again, there's no clear divide between science and mysticism as far as that's concerned.
Absolutely not. In fact, astrology was thought to be essentially the theory of everything. It's how we linked our lives on Earth with the celestial realms. And it was all part of one single continuous thing. It was to do with personality. It was to do with medicine, how you felt, you know, your health. And it was to do with future paths and where you'd come from as well. So it's all wrapped up. The interesting thing is that Kepler really is the first person not to question astrology, but to ask, how it works. And that question, that's an astrophysical question, possibly one of the first astrophysics questions that's ever asked. How is it that the planets influence us? And so he sets on that path to try and find out. And ultimately, of course, it leads to the discrediting of astrology, but it lays the foundation for the discovery of the concept of gravity and the force that really does move all the planets.
You're listening to Little Atoms today with me, Neil Denny, and I'm talking to Dr. Stuart Clark about his book, well, the trilogy of books, The Sky's Dark Labyrinth. But now we're going to be talking about The Sensorium of God, which is the second book in that trilogy. And you've just brought us perfectly onto the main lead character of that book, who is Isaac Newton, who is often described as the first real scientist, but also has also been described as the last mystic. In fact, the very title, The Sensorium of God, is Newton's phrase. Yes, so where does that phrase come from?
It comes actually from his second great work of science, The Optics, published in the early 18th century. And at the end of that book, he wrote essentially a list of queries. And these queries were all the things that he had not been able to get around to investigating and proving, and he was realizing that time was running out for him. So he effectively set a manifesto for what science, proto-science as it was, should investigate next. And this phrase of his, the sensorium of God, was a fundamental mistake. It's catastrophic for Newton, actually. What he believed was that the universe itself was this thing, the sensorium of God, and that God was spread completely throughout the universe. God was time and space, and that the celestial objects being within time and space, he said they were within immediate presence of God. And this could be an explanation, for example, for why God was omnipotent. It also helped Newton because he perceived there to be almost a fatal flaw at the heart of his theory of gravity. And it was that if everything is creating gravity and pulling everything else, why are the stars in the sky? And why have the constellations remained fixed for eons, all the way back to the ancients? The universe should have collapsed. And he believed that it might be. He suggested that this was because they sat within the sensorium of God. God wouldn't allow the universe to collapse, and so God was there holding it up. That gravity, if you like, was almost like the will of God, and he could let things fall to the floor, or he could hold the stars up in the sky. Theologically, this was dynamite, because God was supposed to be this unknowable, all-powerful being, and so any suggestion that he was in any way materialistic, that he was time and space, was absolutely anathema. And this is really the first time, I think, that the concept of science and the investigation of nature as such, and just at base level, at its very heart, is against religion. That they lead you down different paths. So here we see the beginning of the fault line between science and religion.
Well, I mentioned that Newton is often sort of described as the last of the mystics, and everybody would know that he was into alchemy and that. But he was beyond that. He was a very odd character indeed, isn't he?
Yeah, I mean, and once again, you see, this is another reason for wanting to write these as novels. How can you resist a character as complicated as Newton, who has this ability to think so rationally, and defines the scientific method and changes the world. The whole world we live in now is Newtonian, and yet at his core he believed in these strange forces that would mold chemicals and alchemy. He believed that it was possible to find the philosopher's stone through alchemy, which would give you the elixir of youth, which would give you the power of life over death, essentially. And then you fold that in together with his theological beliefs, and he was extremely interested in the power of the Bible as a means of prophecy. He believed that you could tell the future by reading correctly and interpreting correctly the Bible. And he was obsessed with the end of days and the final judgment and the apocalypse as well. And in his life, he must have tried to put all these things together, to craft religion, alchemy, and science all together into a single coherent whole. And being a fictional book, it gave me more leeway to imagine what that that final crafting of the Newtonian final grand theory might have been.
Central to the book is a disagreement between Newton and another one of the major characters, Robert Hooke. And Robert Hooke, possibly because of his rather pugnacious personality, is far less well known nowadays than Newton. So let's talk a little bit about who Robert Hooke was, and then perhaps we can talk about what the disagreements are about.
Yeah, Hooke himself was just a fantastic experimentalist. I mean, I say just, but I mean, he really was an extraordinary experimentalist, and his ability as well to make things, you know, his ability with lathes and with and fashioning the technology of the day, microscopes and things. So he predates Newton very, very slightly. And he was the preeminent natural philosopher, if you like, in London and in the early Royal Society. He was not, however, a mathematician. So he failed to be able to put his notions and his ideas into mathematics. Newton came along with that ability and said that I will put everything in mathematics. Therefore, there'll be no argument. If you can do my maths, you'll know I'm right. And if you find a flaw in my maths, okay, we'll correct it. But there it all is, black and white mathematics. And of course, that left Hooke just wallowing, essentially. And so he became embittered, and he had extraordinarily good insight and made a lot of the early running in trying to understand gravity and why the planets moved as they did. He swapped letters with Newton in 1678, and that almost certainly gave Newton some base level concepts that he could subsequently use. But he never really gave Hooke the credit that Hooke felt he deserved and probably should have had.
The third major character in this book is Edmund Halley, who everybody will know because of the eponymous comet. But again, is not somebody who is that well known as a scientist nowadays. So tell us a little bit about Edmund Halley.
Edmund Halley is the guy you want to go down the pub with. He's an adventurer. He's good looking. He's just up for fun, and he's very clever. And he is the one who, of all of the London natural philosophers, goes to see Newton. And Newton is a recluse and has been a recluse for almost a dozen years at this point. And he goes to see Newton and he says, look, we can't solve this problem of planetary motion. Can you do it? And he sparks this 3-year obsession in Newton, which results in the Principia, the finest work of science ever published. And then later in his life, Halley, he becomes a spy for the British government as well, because he's always off on astronomical trips throughout Europe. So he always comes back with a little piece of juicy information and gossip as well. And then late in his life, he uses Newton's gravity to predict the return of a comet that he's seen in 1682. And so he predicts this event for decades in the future. None of them will be alive at this point. Newton, Halley, Hooke, they're all dead by this point. But the comet comes back exactly on schedule. And this is the crucial experiment, if you like, or one of them, that proves the value of Newtonian science and triggers the Age of Enlightenment.
Well, we're running out of time quickly, but perhaps in the last couple of minutes we can talk about what we can expect from the third book in the trilogy.
Yes, so the third book is the next great watershed in our understanding of the universe. Each of these three moments is when we virtually had to throw away what we thought we knew about the universe and learn a new way of looking at it. So without doubt, that next happens in the early 20th century with Einstein and the development of relativity and the work of the Belgian priest and mathematician Georges Lemaître. Mm-hmm. And how he discovers the Big Bang, the origin of the universe, in Einstein's mathematics. So that's the third book that is currently in my word processor and in my head at the moment.
And the book is going to be called?
It's going to be called The Day Without Yesterday.
Which is a quote from
Georges Lemaître. Yes, he said there was once a day without yesterday, which is how he referred to the Big Bang. His first attempt at naming this origin of the universe was to call it The Bottom of Space and Time. And I didn't think that would work very well for a book title.
Well, you've been listening to Little Atoms today with me, Neil Denny, and with Dr. Stuart Clark, and we've been talking about his trilogy of books, which the latest one is The Sensorium of God, previous book The Sky's Dark Labyrinth, and they're all called The Sky's Dark Labyrinth Trilogy. So, Stu, thanks very much for coming on the show again today.
You're more than welcome, Neil. Thank you.
You've been listening to Little Atoms. You can find details of upcoming guests at our website, littleatoms.com. The Little Atoms podcast is available on iTunes. Thanks for listening.